Genesis 48, I want to talk about Jacob blessing the two sons of Joseph, Ephraim and Manasseh. We must remember Hebrews 11:21 that says that when he blessed those boys, he did so by faith. Let's remember that. Now, the children of Jacob had come down there into Egypt, and as we know, they were multiplying. There were 70 or so of them who came down, and they multiplied to the point that they were going to be persecuted in the future, and they had got on very well. And so he reminds them in verses 4 and 5 of the promises that he'd been given that applied to them. He said that God had appeared to him at Luz in the land of Canaan and blessed him and said to him, "Behold, I will make you fruitful and multiply you, and I will make of you a company of peoples, and will give you this land, that is the land of Canaan, to your seed after you for an everlasting possession." Well, we're told in Genesis 47, verse 11, that Jacob's children were given a possession in the land of Egypt. In fact, Joseph was given the land of Egypt. It's in Genesis 41. Using these very same words about how the land of Canaan had been given to the children of Abraham and Jacob. So he can see the problem that his children had multiplied, and they had been given a possession in a land, the land of Egypt, but he wanted them to realize that this is not the real thing. This is not actually the real promise that God gave us. We have been promised the land of Canaan, and I think he was implying they should return there. And I'm going to argue a bit later in these talks that actually that was the intention, that they would have just come down temporarily to escape the famine and then return. So he's warning them that despite all your apparent achievement, multiplication, fruitfulness, and inheritance or possession here in Egypt, this is not the real thing. Now, this is absolutely relevant to us, really. We who apparently have some sort of possession in this world, we who are experiencing the primary fulfillment of God's blessing. It certainly puts pay to the prosperity gospel that the idea is that you're going to get fantastically wealthy and blessed in this life. Because he's saying, be careful about all that sort of thinking. This is not the real thing. Now you may think, well, I'm not particularly blessed. Well, we may not be compared to the billionaire who lives down the street or whatever. And of course, we can always find other people in society who've got a far better deal than us. But I think it'll be true to say for the vast majority of us that we enjoy a far more prosperous and softer life than our ancestors did. Even go back 2, 3, 4 generations in your family. What have you got? You've got electricity, you've got internet, you've got hot water, many people, certainly water, just on tap. You don't have to get it out of a well. You can have light come on just at the press of a switch. You haven't got to go through the grief of oil lamps and a torch, as in a burning torch, and all this kind of thing. We live in luxury. Our ancestors would look at our lives and think, wow, so my great-great-grandson or great-great-granddaughter, oh man, they made it big time, huh? Well, it's all relative, isn't it? And the warning is, don't be fooled by apparent prosperity. This is trial by prosperity, trial by the soft life. And we do have this, and Jacob perceived this, and he's warning his sons. That's why he blesses them by faith. And he then takes Ephraim and Manasseh, and he says that he wants them to become his firstborn. Now, all right, he does this by faith, we're told in Hebrews 11, but the flesh and the spirit, as we all know from our own experience, can work together, unfortunately, and coexist too easily. So he wants Ephraim and Manasseh Joseph's children, to replace his Reuben and Simeon. He says, they will be mine. Now, Reuben and Simeon were Jacob's first two sons, and he's saying that they are to be replaced by Joseph's sons as his firstborn. Well, what was quite going on here? Joseph was the son of his favourite wife, Rachel, whereas Reuben and Simeon weren't. And so, you know, Deuteronomy 21 is quite clear that a man was not to make the sons of his favourite wife the firstborn. The sons of the hated or the less loved wife were to be the firstborn if that's who they were. They were not to be replaced by the sons of the favourite wife. Now, I understand that Deuteronomy, of course, comes sometime after this, but I think the law of Moses was largely repeating divine principle that had perhaps already been expressed in one way or another. So he's not actually making Joseph, the son of his favourite wife, his firstborn, but he makes Joseph's sons his firstborns to replace Reuben and Simeon, his first two actual sons. Well, what are we to make of this? He does it by faith, we are told in Hebrews 11, and we must give that its due weight. And yet I think he had faith, and yet he was also operating according to the flesh, because there seems no particular ultimate reason in spiritual terms for him doing this. He was favouring the sons of Rachel, his favourite wife, over those of Leah, who was his not favoured wife, or you could say his hated wife in that sense. So, flesh and spirit coexist, do they not? And you see this in a man on his deathbed. And that's a comfort, that we shall die imperfect. In fact, Jacob's last words really were talking about the territory that he had taken out of the hand of the Amorite. He says, by my bow, by my sword and by my bow, I took the territory of the Amorites and I give it to you. Well, in the Psalms we read that they did not take the land in possession by their sword nor by their bow, but by God's grace. So he gets to the end of his life, and actually his last words are still reflective of immaturity, shall we say, spiritual immaturity, or at very least unwisdom. Or more to the point, I think this was a lack of faith and a lack of getting it, as he should have done, that it was not by his sword and bow, it was all of God's grace. So I think it's comfort that we don't die perfect, and we shall all be saved by grace at the last day. And if that is the case, which it is, then we need to remember that about others whose irritating weaknesses are rather too much for us at times. And sure, folks will die with those weaknesses, but that does not mean that they therefore will not be saved. And if you expect, as it were, or look forward to salvation, knowing that you shall die imperfect, well, you better cut that slack to your brethren. So he then says, verse 8, when he sees Joseph's sons, he says, and who are these? I think the idea is, whose are these? In other words, they are going to be mine. Joseph says, these are my sons whom God has given me here. Well, they bring them near to him, and they bow before him, and Joseph takes them, Ephraim in his right hand, verse 13, toward Israel's left hand, Manasseh in his left hand towards Israel's right hand, and brought them near to him. But then Israel crosses his hands over. He stretched out his right hand, put it on Ephraim's head, who was the younger, and his left hand on Manasseh's head, because he was actually the firstborn of Joseph's sons. So Jacob is making a big deal about this blessing thing. He's saying that, no, I want to make sure that the younger is blessed, that the younger is blessed as the firstborn, not the firstborn. In any case, I'm using your firstborn to replace my firstborn's. Well, he ought to have learnt at this point in his life, and he is about to die, that all this angst about the father's blessing is nonsense. You remember all the deception that he practiced on Esau and on his own blind father Isaac to ensure, as he thought, that he should get the blessing. And all that angst was just not worth it. And anyway, even after he's done that, and he has to flee from Esau, his brother, who he'd deceived out of the blessing, and Esau's trying to kill him, so he has to run away, but his father comes to him, Isaac, and just as he's sending him off to Mesopotamia, he says, look, let me give you now the blessing of Abraham. Well, that's the only blessing worth having. When years later Jacob prepares to meet Esau, fearing Esau's going to remember all this and kill him, he sends Esau loads of presents, and then he says to him in Genesis 33, take away my blessing. Many of the English versions say take my blessing, but it's the word for take away. Take away my blessing. He's saying to Esau, look, have it back. It's his own way of apology, I suppose, of what he'd done to Esau and Isaac. He's saying, look, take away my blessing. And he goes on, for I have all and abound. And he says, take away my blessing because I have seen God and lived. In other words, I've got God's grace. That's everything. For me, I don't want all that material blessing. Now, there are times in human life when you come down very small before God, and yet you only get those cards dealt to you, as it were, a few times in the game of life, and the idea is that you are to remain small. And yet, I think with Jacob, he did come down very small before Esau, and he realized that all this angst about material blessing and having the blessing of your father and that was all nonsense. The only thing that mattered was the blessing of Abraham. So he got there at that point, but now at the end of his life, he's slumped back to the old deception and trying to do it by human strength, crossing his hands over, making sure he gives the younger the blessing over the firstborn and all that. He is still not really acceptant that really blessing is neither here nor there, the blessing of fathers. It is the blessing of God given to Abraham, which is the significant thing. That is the gospel. So he did this by faith, we're told. And yes, as I've said, he was very wise to point out to them that, look, this great life in Egypt is not the real deal. Have faith. Look to the everlasting possession, not of this land, but of Canaan. So he had it right, and yet he had it wrong. And as I say, he dies imperfect. And it's a message to us, I think, that when you come down small before God, it may have a health issue in your life or in the life of somebody close to you. Something may hit you out of left field that drives you to your knees. Could be financial, could be all sorts of things. Your husband or your wife might leave you or whatever it might be. And you're driven to your knees and you're very small before God, and inevitably, I don't think it's just me when I've had those situations, but I think for all of us, you think of your sins and you do humble yourself. But the important thing is to remain like that. And, you know, God doesn't give you, for example, a cancer scare every 2 months to bring you down small before him. He only gives you these things a few times in your life. And I think that we are to remain little in our own eyes. We are to remain very small before God, humble, full of gratitude. And, you know, it's that fullness of gratitude, that thankful spirit, which is the antidote to any temptation to pride, which is so obnoxious to God. So he doesn't quite make it. He slips back into this old obsession about the blessing of the father and all that. So, yeah, there's weakness and there's strength. And you know, it's all mixed within him. And Joseph objects to this, but his father refuses. And he says, I know, he also, your firstborn will also become a people and will also be great, but his younger brother will be greater than he, and his seed will become a multitude of nations. Well, as I say, I think that this is Jacob trying to sort of justify in the end his own deception of Esau, his own obsession with getting the fatherly blessing. Even though, as I say, when he comes down small before Esau later on in his life, he does resign it and say, yeah, sure, what on earth was all that angst about? And in any case, I don't think these blessings of the fathers were particularly significant anyway. He obviously wants Manasseh to be the firstborn and to have great multiplication, etc., over Ephraim. But did that really happen? Manasseh was the firstborn, but he wants Ephraim to be the firstborn. Did that really work out? Was Ephraim super blessed? I don't know. I mean, the 10 tribes were known as Ephraim, but they were not spiritually blessed at all, were they? They went into captivity in Assyria, never returned, and really dropped right away from being God's people. And as I say, these last words of his are very mixed. As I say in verse 22, I've given to you Shechem, which I took out of the hand of the Amorite with my sword and with my bow. Well, as I said in Psalm 44, and also actually at the end of Joshua, it's emphasized that the land was given to Israel not on account of their sword and their bow, but purely by God's grace. So I'm not saying Jacob won't be in the kingdom. He will be in the kingdom. But you see here his weakness. You really do. That he dies very imperfect. He never really totally got over that besetting weakness of self-reliance and this desire to justify himself and his own grabbing of the fatherly blessing from his brother Esau. He never quite gets over that. As I say, halfway through his life when he meets Esau, he comes down very small before God and man and resigns it and says, yeah, what was all that angst about anyway, about all that material stuff? But as I say here at the end, he still is back with that obsession about the younger should be blessed before the firstborn and all that, and trying to replace his own firstborns with the wife, the grandchildren of his favorite wife Rachel and so on. So, as I say, that is Jacob, and it's going to be us as well, because you and I are not going to come to the end of it all perfect. Not at all. And yet we shall, like Jacob, be saved by grace. And this, if we are going to expect that and look forward to that, this really shows that you must cut others slack who are also going to die imperfect. It's just that we see other people's imperfections and immaturities and the stubborn way they hold on to their besetting weaknesses right up to their grave planks. We see that far clearer than, of course, we do in ourselves. But those things are just as true of us.